Sacheha Viprarajar Shir Mahishya Shatarupaya Ayasyati Didrikshustvam Parashvo Dharmako Vidaha Sacheha Viprarajar Shir Mahishya Shatarupaya Ayasyati Didrikshustvam Parashvo Dharmako Vidaha Saha Swayambhuva Manu Cha and Iha Here Vipra O Holy Brahmana Raja Vishihi The Saintly King Mahishya Along with his Queen Shatarupaya, called Shatarupa, Ayasyati, will come, Didrikshuhu, desiring to see, Twam, you, Parashvaha, the day after tomorrow. Dharma, in religious activities. Kovidaha, expert. Translation by Srila Prabhupada. The day after tomorrow, O Brahmana, that celebrated emperor, who is expert in religious activities, will come here with his queen, Shatarupa, wishing to see you. No purport. I'll read the next verse. Atma jam asita pangim vayak shila gunanvitam brigayantim patim dasyat anurupayate prabho. He has a grown-up daughter whose eyes are black. She is ready for marriage, and she has good character and all good qualities. She is also searching for a good husband. My dear sir, her parents will come to see you, who are exactly suitable for her, just to deliver their daughter as your wife. Purport. The selection of a good husband for a good girl was always entrusted to the parents. Here it is clearly stated that Manu and his wife were coming to see Kardama Muni to offer their daughter because the daughter was well qualified and the parents were searching out a similarly qualified man. This is the duty of parents. Girls are never thrown into the public street to search out their husband. For when girls are grown up and are searching after a boy, they forget to consider whether the boy they select is actually suitable for them. Out of the urge of sex desire, a girl may accept anyone. But if the husband is chosen by the parents, they can consider who is to be selected and who is not. According to the Vedic system, therefore, the girl is given over to a suitable boy by the parents. She is never allowed to select her own husband independently. According to the Vedic system, Prabhupada says here. So earlier in the purport when he says, a girl is never thrown into, girls are never thrown into the public street to search out their husband. Well, unfortunately they are. It's within the Vedic system that this is not done. But we're not living nowadays in the Vedic system. Even India is changing. You wouldn't see these things happening even 10, 15, certainly 15 years ago. First of all, women dressing as prostitutes, young women dressing like prostitutes would not, 10, 15 years ago. And then, it just naturally leads to flirtation. So in the universities and other places that where the children are away from the parents, the girls are consorting with the boys freely, and there's illicit sex. It's going on. Girls get pregnant. Or even if they don't, everybody knows they're fooling around. And no decent boy wants to marry the girl. These things are happening now among the progressive members of Indian society, the rich and intelligent. They're breaking the ancient principles that have been maintained for thousands of years. And now young girls are, just like in the West, behaving like prostitutes, even if their motive is good, that they want to get a husband and have security in their life. That's natural for a young woman, a young girl. She's looking for a husband. Without a husband, what is she? Nothing. She has no security. She, you know, is she going to be a spinster and live with her parents forever? You know, so normal thing is a girl is expected to get married. She's looking for, of course she's looking for a husband. Why shouldn't she? But the parents should find her a husband. She shouldn't be thrown out into the street, as they're already starting to do. Of course the girls think they want this. They want to dress and act like the girls in the Western countries. Why not? Why maintain these stupid old superstitions? Just because our parents did it. It's a good reason not to do it. So they want to change. They think they want the change. But the change means that they have to become like prostitutes, and their actual purpose of getting a good husband is spoiled. Okay, they have the freedom to consort with the boys, but then nobody wants to, no decent person wants to marry them. Then they have to go to the West to find a husband, a Western husband, because the Indians won't marry them. So, unfortunately, the Vedic system isn't being maintained, and it creates chaos. Whatever is still good in India, whatever little is still good in India, whatever hasn't been spoiled already, is on the verge of being spoiled. The last vestiges of Vedic culture are on the point of being destroyed. Strishu dushtashu konteya jayate varna sankaraha. When the women become corrupt, then the natural consequence is unwanted children. Children that were not planned for, that were not, for whom Garbhadhan Samskara was not done. And therefore, who are very spiritually unfit, unruly, and degraded. They're born degraded because of the misbehavior of the girls. Because the women are engaging in illicit sex before marriage or even in marriage, they're having children without Garbhadhan Samskara, that is also illicit sex. And therefore the result is not good. The children are not fit for spiritual culture. They're degraded from very birth. And then the whole society goes to hell. That's how it starts. And it's happening now in India. Until very recently, I saw it with my own eyes, the change, in the 28 years since I first came to India. Anyone who's been here, was here 12 years ago, can see the difference. That before, young boys and girls would not think of having illicit sex. Not that Indians don't have the same hormones. Not that their minds are completely free from desire to enjoy. But they have this conscience that how can I disappoint my parents by doing such a thing? There's allegiance to the parents. And therefore, at least until very recently, young Indian men and women were very much more successful in avoiding illicit sex than Westerners. They just basically didn't do it. Now they're starting to do it. You know, the last vestiges, the last thing that kept India more civilized than the rest of the world is now being destroyed. So these material principles, although they are material, the sannyasis and brahmacharis shouldn't be concerned about these material things. But they should be concerned. Somebody should be concerned. Human society has to be organized. The spiritual leaders have to see that the spiritual organization is done, the organization of Varnashram Dharma. If the conditioned souls are not engaged in regulated sense gratification, they'll engage in unregulated sense gratification and live like cats and dogs. So the brahmanas and the saintly kings have to see that everybody else is engaged in a way that is progressive, that is not degrading. Both Kardama and Swayambhuva are in the vanguard of this movement to protect the principles of religion. This is in Satya Yuga. Lord Kapila appears as Yuga Avatar in Satya Yuga. There are so many Satya Yugas, but at least, you know, Satya Yuga occurs so many times in the cycle of creation. Hundreds of thousands of Satya Yugas, but this is a Satya Yuga. We don't know which one offhand. And in Satya Yuga, people are relatively pious, relatively qualified for spiritual life. But even in the beginning of the Satya Yuga, it is necessary to struggle, strive vigorously to maintain the principles of religion. Because the general course of history is toward degradation. If the saintly people, the brahmanas and kshatriyas, do not push for the maintenance of religion, things will degrade. Even in Satya Yuga. So, in the beginning of creation, Swayambhuva Manu is the first of the 14 Manus. So at least in each day of Brahma, he's the first. It may not be Brahma's very first day, but let's see. This is third canto is describing the current Manvantara, the current day of Brahma, the Shweta Varaha Kalpa, not the beginning of the very Brahma's life. He's actually 50 in his 51st year, and it's 11:30 in the morning now, currently. In Brahma's, I guess, his birthday. And this is going back a bit to the Swayambhuva Manvantara. We're now in the seventh Manvantara. Go back to the first Manvantara of that cycle. First day of Brahma's second half of his life. That's what's being described here. The Satya Yuga in that Swayambhuva Manvantara. And this Swayambhuva Manu is very much in the vanguard of working to establish and maintain these principles, practical principles of religion for human society. He may not be known as a preacher of pure Krishna consciousness, the way that Narada is, or even their great-grandfather Brahma. So many instructions on pure Krishna consciousness spoken by them in Srimad Bhagavatam. Brahma, Narada, especially these two. Narada is preaching to so many people in the Bhagavatam. And he's speaking unconditional, uncompromising, pure Krishna consciousness. Unalloyed Krishna consciousness. Swayambhuva Manu, we don't hear much from him in Srimad Bhagavatam. This is his chance to speak. He's on stage in this chapter, chapter 21 of the third canto. And he has a conversation with Kardama Muni. I don't know if Swayambhuva Manu, you know, he previously
inquired
from Brahma, what can we do? The earth is submerged. How can I'm supposed to rule the human race, but the earth is required to establish the human race, and the earth is sunk in the Garbhadak ocean. So we heard from Swayambhuva Manu for one or two verses back in the, 13th, 14th chapter of the third canto. Now we're going to hear him speak, and I don't know if he speaks again anywhere in the Bhavatam, Swayambhuva Manu. And when he speaks now, it's going to be about getting his daughter married. That's what the conversation is going to be. He doesn't have an opportunity to speak on the topic of pure Krishna consciousness, which is really the theme of Srimad Bhagavatam, devotional service to the Supreme Lord, unconditional devotional service. Savai pumsam paro dharmo yato bhaktir hoksaje ohoi tukiya apatahita yayatma supersedita. This, as spoken by Sutta in the very beginning of the Bhagavatam, is the theme, is the proper subject matter of the Bhagavatam. That the highest duty, the highest responsibility of human life is whatever activity will help develop pure devotion for Lord Vasudeva at Hoksaja. And that devotion should be uninterrupted and unmotivated. Pure devotional service. That is the theme of the Bhagavatam. And Swayambhuva Manu is not going to be allowed to speak on that theme. He's not empowered to do it. He doesn't have the opportunity. But it does not mean that he's not a pure devotee. We don't hear him speak again, but we do hear about him later on, I think, toward the end of the third canto, how Swayambhuva Manu practiced pure Krishna consciousness, even though he was a grihastha and a kshatriya. He every day heard, even though he had a very busy schedule managing the human race. We have businessmen who manage one corporation and they have to work 18, 20 hours a day doing that. Well, to speak of, you have to manage the whole human race all over the universe. How busy you'll be. So Swayambhuva Manu is a very busy administrator. He didn't have much time for doing parikramas and taking vrats and so on. But every day he found time, he put it in the schedule to hear Krishna Katha every day in his home. And because of that, he perfected his life and went back to Godhead, simply by hearing Krishna Katha. Therefore, Swayambhuva Manu is a pure devotee. He attained perfection in that lifetime. But he was not an empowered preacher of Krishna consciousness. He instead was empowered to preach Varnashram Dharma. It is something less, it is on a lower level, but it's required. The conditioned souls need to be told how to organize their lives. Those who are not ready and interested seriously in Krishna consciousness, they still need to be directed in a progressive way. So the Varnashram system was enunciated by Swayambhuva Manu in the Manusmriti, Manusamhita. And there's not much in the Manu Samhita about Krishna consciousness. Something in the beginning, in the first chapter. Some glorification of Vishnu. But the whole book is about everything else but pure Krishna consciousness. It's about material principles of the organization of human society. The material obligations and privileges and rules for each different class, each varna and ashrama. So the topic is material, but it's required, it serves a spiritual purpose. We use material things in the service of Krishna, and that is yukta vairagya. So Swayambhuva Manu was practicing yukta, appropriate renunciation, by engaging his material knowledge in educating the human race how to live in a civilized way. So this is very advantageous for progressive human society if even the material leaders, the kings and the legislators, Swayambhuva Manu is the first legislator. He made the rule book. all by himself. And his disciple Bhrigu Muni spoke it to the sages. The Manusmriti, Manusamhita that we have now, is as heard and repeated by Bhrigu Muni. It's the Bhrigu recension of the Manusmriti that we have. It is very advantageous for us that even the material leaders, the rulers and the administrators and legislators like Swayambhuva, are pure devotees. If the kings, if the teachers, even the material teachers, the top teachers of material subjects, are devotees, then human society is going in the right direction. The devotees themselves, those who are fully absorbed in simply hearing and chanting Krishna's glories, they may not think that they have any need for social organization. But everybody else needs their help in learning how to organize their lives. The devotees, even if they don't need it for themselves, everyone else needs their guidance. The Varnashram, if it's taught by the pure devotees, if it's directed, organized by the pure devotees, then it's Daivi Varnashram. It becomes Asura Varnashram, materialistic Varnashram, when materialistic people organize it. The Asuras, the demons who are opponents of the demigods, they also have some semblance of Vedic culture. They follow many of the principles of Vedic culture, even though they're demons. Great demons, the ones who are originally coming from the Patala Loka, but took birth on Earth at the end of Dwarpa Yuga, demons like Shishupala, Jarasandha, they were actually very civilized. For demons, they were very civilized. They were charitable. They fought fairly. They administered properly. Duryodhana was an excellent manager of the government. The people did not suffer under Duryodhana's guidance, except that he was an enemy of Krishna and his devotees. But as a ruler, he was pretty competent. And these other demons also were civilized men. They were following in their own way, in their own perverted way, the Vedic culture. But that becomes demoniac Varnashram when it's organized by demons. When pure devotees are the establishers of Varnashram system, then it's Daivi Varnashram. And that is what was established by Swayambhuva Manu. And that is what Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur had the vision should be reestablished. That not just Varnashrama, but Daivi Varnashrama. Varnashrama led and organized by pure devotees for the glorification of the Supreme Lord and for engaging everybody ultimately in the Supreme Lord's pure service. That is required. Bhaktivinoda Thakur had that vision. And he instructed his son, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, to implement this Daivi Varnashram. Explicit instructions are there. In letters, we can read one or two letters where Bhaktivinoda is ordering his son to do this. To develop Sri Dham Mayapur and reestablish Daivi Varnashram. These are the two, and print books. These are the principal instructions of Bhaktivinoda Thakur to his son. And we can see in the Gaudiya Math that that work was begun. As in contrast to other spiritual organizations and even other communities of Gaudiya Vaishnavas, we don't all dress in white as Babaji's or whatever. The Babaji's wear white and the Grihasthas wear white. You know, there's no saffron. It's actually frowned upon, the saffron, among the Babaji's and Goswamis. You can quote Shastra telling us how it's hellish to wear saffron. But Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, carrying out the order of his father to reestablish Varnashram Dharma, Daivi Varnashram, he dressed his disciples, distinguishing them as Grihasthas, Brahmacharis, Grihasthas, and Sannyasis. And they dressed differently, and they had some different rules to follow. what was licit for a grihastha is illicit for a brahmachari, and vice versa. Different principles and different dress. So the distinct he made, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, in the Gaudiya Mutt, established the distinctions of ashrama that were ignored by the Gaudiya Vaishnavas previously, in many cases ignored. Few communities of Gaudiya Vaishnavas had sannyas and so on, but it was rare. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati established it institutionally in the Gaudiya Mutt, division of the ashramas. But that's only half the Varnashram system. The other half that he left to his disciple, Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, was to establish the Varnas, the distinction of the Varnas. And Prabhupada hasn't done that yet. That hasn't been actually accomplished in ISKCON yet. Organization of the separate Varnas, that you pick one of them, or you're assigned one of the Varnas, and you stay to it. A person who is very competent spiritually can do many things. Things that he's empowered to do by Krishna that, according to his material capacity, he wouldn't be able to do. But unless you're a perfect Paramahamsa, to try to juggle all these balls and be everything at once is very difficult for us. It sometimes leads to confusion and failure. A person, just like you have a bicycle, in the West, the bicycles have many gears. I don't know how many gears they sell nowadays. When I was young, it was 10 gears and then 15 gears. I don't know how many gears they have on bicycles now. 21 gears. So you have 21 different speeds you can ride the bicycle at. Now you're going up a hill. There's several different gears you could pick. Depends how you want to ride, how you feel. But you have to pick one of them. You have to fit into a gear and stay and stick on it. You can't just be sliding around back and forth from one gear to another. You have to pick one gear and ride it. Like that. You may have some competence as a kshatriya and as a brahmana. But you have to pick one or the other and ride that gear. Be a brahmana or a kshatriya. Don't try to be both or three varnas or four varnas all at once. It doesn't work. It doesn't make for a smooth ride. You pick one position in society and function in that position, even if you're capable of being more than one thing. Not simultaneously. It doesn't work. So that is what has to be done in ISKCON. Separate the Varna activities, the qualities, that's individual for everybody. And nobody's purely sattvic or rajasic. There's always mixture. And even the occupations are mixed. Just like some brahmanas only study shastra. Other brahmanas give advice to the government. So that's getting a little rajasic when you're involved with the government, when you're a government advisor. It's a different kind of brahmana. So they're mixtures. But still, a brahmana, even Jaya Shikurini Tai, even a brahmana who's engaged in the service of the government, he's got a line beyond which he's not going to go. He should try to be an advisor to the government without taking money, without becoming a paid servant, without being obliged to the government to do what they want. He should maintain his independence, even if he's involved with politics. Nowadays in India, most of the politicians are so-called brahmanas, but they're extremely corrupt. They should be ashamed to call themselves brahmanas. But a proper brahmana is very careful how he gets involved with politicians. He has to draw the line by past which he doesn't go. Things he just doesn't do. As a brahmana. So that we have to learn in ISKCON. We have to actually organize it. And especially devise educational systems for training up devotees in how to understand their varna position and how to function in it. The brahmanas have to be trained up in shastric education, also in character. Similarly, the kshatriyas have to be trained up. Both brahmanas and kshatriyas have to be, there has to be brahminical training, kshatriya training, and then vaishya and shudra training, that's simple. There are already so many schools in the world that teach business and teach trades. We don't even have to make separate schools, or we can just copy those schools. But for brahminical training and kshatriya training, we need special educational systems. A Brahmin can spend most of his life being educated, trained up. Vedic education, to become expert in one Veda, can take 12 years. And if you want to become Chaturvedi, it can take 48 years. Your education, before you're finished, just being, you know, being a student. At least it should take several years to be trained up as a functioning Brahmana. And Kshatriya also, thorough training, because he has to learn politics, he has to learn how to fight. These things take time to learn. That is what ISKCON should be doing, is developing the educational systems and establishing the training of devotees to take up these roles. Without that, you don't have proper Brahmins and Kshatriyas. They don't just grow on trees or fall out of the sky. They have to be trained up. And we have to have functioning Brahmins and functioning Kshatriyas to establish Varnashrama culture. When Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was on the earth 500 years ago, at least in the community of Brahmins that he was living in, there was still some Vedic culture, some Varnashram culture. He was living in a community in Navadvip of proper Brahmanas who had principles, who had culture. This is all the infrastructure of the Varnashram system. Of course, it had a Bengali slant on it. It wasn't the same, exactly the same ancient way of doing things. But still, it was Vedic. The Varnashram was more or less intact in the community of devotees, Brahmanas, that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu appeared in. Nowadays, that's practically lost. 500 years later, that support, that infrastructure is not available. And therefore, it's much more difficult for most people to even begin practicing Krishna consciousness. Unless you have social support, how can you practice Krishna consciousness? If most people are not completely self-motivated. They need social support. They need peer examples, they need guidance. We have a few thousands of devotees who have managed to join ISKCON, who have left their material lives, moved into ashrams, got in training, maybe they went out and got married again, but they managed to break themselves off from the material culture. But only a few tens of thousands of persons are able to do that. For everybody else, we have to provide them the social support, so that even remaining in their material positions, they can become transformed by participating in Varnashram organization, in accepting their understanding and functioning properly according to their role, their Varna and their Ashrama. We may not need it. We may be Paramahamsa or whatever, or Avaduta, but everybody else needs it. And actually, most of us need it too. We're not Paramahamsas and Avadutas, many of us. So we need some material support also. Therefore, Prabhupada gave vivid and elaborate instructions about this. So many purports in the Bhagavatam talk about Varnashram principles, and in walks and discussions, Prabhupada talks about it a lot, especially after 1973, after Prabhupada had established the basis of ISKCON. Then he started talking about the next phase of establishing Varnashram culture, re-establishing Daivi Varnashram. He talked about it a lot, but not much, even up to now, has been done to implement it. This is Prabhupada's unfinished business. He said, near the end of his pastimes, that 50% of my work is still undone. And this is a good part of that 50%, is establishing Varnashram. Hare Krishna. Okay, so I'll stop there. Does anybody have any questions or comments? Yes,
how do the Babaji's deal with the description that Vajitanya wore saffron cloth?
Oh, but he took Mayavad Sannyas. He was also a Mayavadi, externally. That's his Leela. He can be excused of that. He's God, he can play like a Mayavadi if he wants. He wasn't acting, he wasn't a Mayavadi. He took Sannyas in the Mayavad order. That's highly irregular, but that's his divine Leela. We don't recommend that any follower of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu also take Mayavad Sannyas, Ekadandi Sannyas. So the Babaji's, or those who, you know, look down on saffron, they say nobody should imitate that. Nobody should take Sannyas at all. Even though Lord Chaitanya had, not only himself, He had 9 prominent sannyasis who were among his closest associates, and a few others after Lord Chaitanya also took sannyas. But anyway, the Babaji, you know, don't see that something that should be imitated or practiced. That's okay for Mahaprabhu and his direct associates, but not for us. That's their idea. And they'll quote so many shastras, Dharma shastras and others, that say that in Kali Yuga, sannyas is forbidden, and that Vaishnav shouldn't wear rakta, red. Because Rupa Goswami says, one of the aparads in seva, in deity worship, is to wear red or blue cloth. I think it actually has to do with the fact that Srimati Radharani wears blue and something else, and therefore we don't want to look better than you know, Srimati Radharani or Krishna, so therefore we don't wear red and blue. We don't dress nice too nicely in front of the deities. But they take that statement to mean that it's forbidden to wear saffron. Yeah, don't wear red. The Prabhupada, devotees question Prabhupada about that rule. So we shouldn't wear red or blue in the temple? Prabhupada responded by getting angry and saying, I'll make you all wear red and blue. You know, he didn't want us to make a big thing out of that rule. In other words, we don't have to even observe it, as far as Prabhupada is concerned. Don't wear red and blue in the temple. The idea is don't dress better than the deities dressed.
Is that the main thing that they quote when they say that you should
wear saffron? No, then they quote from Dharma Shastra as well. Ashramedam gavalambam pitrapaitukam devarenus Ashram galavalambam sanyasyam sanyasam pitrapaitrikam devarena satotpati kalal pancha vivarjiet. I don't know where this is quoted from, but it's in the Chaitanya Charitamrita that in Kali Yuga these 5 things are forbidden. You know this quote? Okay, so the ashramedha sacrifice, the cow and horse sacrifices are forbidden. In general, sacrificing animals is forbidden in Kali Yuga. And sannyasa is forbidden in Kali Yuga, according to Karmakanda principles. This is Smriti, Dharma Shastra, saying this. Pitrapaitrikam, offering flesh to the forefathers in the Shraddha. So in Kali Yuga, you offer parodasha, the rice cake, instead, as a substitute for the meatball, pinda. And then Devarenu Satotpati, the widow being impregnated by the younger brother of the deceased, that's forbidden in Kali Yuga. Vyasadeva did that for his young older brother. Your older brother? No, wasn't brother. Vyasadeva was uncle, actually, right? But he was requested by the mother to come and do it. Anyway, but in Kali Yuga, that's forbidden. You know, for the younger brother to substitute for the deceased older brother to beget children in the widow. Sannyasa is on that list. So that and other statements are quoted saying it's just forbidden in Kali Yuga. Okay.
It's not a question of mentioning how you heard that Brihu Muni heard it from Svamguru Manu as a disciple. Is it unusual that a very prominent Brahma like Brihu would become a disciple of a kshatriya?
Well, it happened in Naimisharanya that Shonika and the most prominent Vedic sages sat at the feet of Suta Goswami. Shukadev, who wasn't even initiated, gave instruction to all the great devotees, including his own guru, Vyasadeva, his father, and his father's guru, Narada, were both sitting at Shukadev's feet. So there are exceptional cases like that. Svayambhuva is a Rajarshi. Even though he's a king, he's a rishi. So Bhrigu, to get this knowledge of Vanashram organization, he went to the authority, Svayambhuva. That's not really out of order. Someone has knowledge, you should accept him as guru. The Brahmins who won't listen to anybody else because they're not Brahmins, That's too pedantic, too stereotyped. If someone has knowledge that you lack, and he has a proper command, and he's pure, you should accept him as teacher, no matter what his social position is. Okay? Hare Krishna. Anything else? Okay, thank you. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Hare Krishna.